Hi, and welcome to another episode of Financial Market Insights. Today, we're delighted to have Peter Lowry of Chronicle Software Solutions on to talk to us about a subject I've been involved in for many years, which is software trading, particularly low latency. Welcome, Peter.
I'm really pleased to be here. And it's been a while since I did a podcast, so I love talking about this stuff.
So, Peter, I think I know a bit about your company, but I think it's interesting, and you fit into an if-you-know-them kind of category. It's a very specialist market. So tell us about the company first, and then perhaps we'll get off talking a bit about you.
Yeah, so I was working for a number of different hedge funds and investment banks in the past, and I loved trying to solve the hardest problems. That's what interested me. Unfortunately, I was reasonably good at that in the sense that I solved the hardest problems, and then we'd get a bit bored, really, and then I'd move on. So I decided that actually, after going through like the last three roles were about 6 months long, I decided that maybe I needed to work for myself and do consulting. And so that's how I started about 11 years ago, doing consulting. And that was actually a lot harder than I expected. One of the challenges is that because if you're doing a 1 week gig, every week is like your first week on the job, except you need to deliver by Friday. And I found that both interesting, but also very challenging. And over time, the company evolved more into having products, and I have a team of consultants. And so I'm not going through that process myself anymore. So I'm more managing the team. But yeah, certainly to start with, it was a huge, much bigger adjustment than I expected. You know, because like I said, like every week was like my first week on the job. But now I've got a range of open source software. And that's how most people know us, from the open source software. And some clients pay for us like commercial extensions and consulting. And that's how we make our revenue.
Cool. And that's quite some bragging, right? So you've got 8 of the 11 top 10 investment banks as clients.
Yes.
So what sets you apart from everyone else in this field?
I think it's that despite being a very small company, we're pretty patient with our clients. I think one of the key things engaging with any investment bank you need is take a long-term view, because it takes so long to get onboarded and to actually from the time they pay you. So that can be 3 to 5 years. And for a small company, that's a long time to wait. And I think that's what discourages a lot of other small companies from even really considering it, because they don't, you know, they're not thinking on those sort of timescales. In our case, it's also that because we've got the open source, a lot of clients already know about us. They've used the open source and they would like more than what that offers. And that gives us a big boost. We get about 13,000 downloads a month from different IP addresses, 13,000 IP addresses download us every month. That's our key open source product. So we don't get any money from that, but we get free marketing as a result. And then that really helps enormously.
Yeah, no, that's a cool business model. I can tell you, and we're going to have to remain nameless here, I've done lots of work with large investment banks, some inside, but some externally as a consultant. And American investment banks are currently the leaders in my procurement process timeline. So I completely get your 3 to 5 years is quite a long while, but one household name did take over 15 months to get through the process. So I get that completely. So once you've got these people and you're working with, alongside, inside to some extent, them and their systems, what comes as challenging to you? So describe to us a particularly challenging problem and the solution for it.
Yeah, so a very common challenge is organizational constraints. So often the challenge isn't really technical, but that's what we have to work with. Often the client has some interesting organizational constraints that they're not able to work around. So one example was I did some consulting for an American investment bank, and they wanted to improve the performance of their software, and in particular their higher percentile latencies, you know, their worst outcomes. But their constraint was they couldn't change their hardware or their software, which at the time I thought of tried to, you know, gently ease them into the idea we might have to change some of the software. As it turned out, I mean, the first step in any of these engagements is you do your analysis. You figure out what is it doing? Where is it spending its time? And within a couple of weeks, we could see that, oh, this was misconfigured. So we changed the configuration. And then we found out, well, this software doesn't work efficiently. It's not fit for purpose. But hey, someone's actually written a solution to this. They just, 3 years ago, they just weren't able to convince anyone to use it. So again, through configuration, it was just enabling software that was already there. And this just went on for pretty much the whole month. And it turned out that we changed no software at all in the end, no hardware. And we reduced the 99.9 percentile, which is worth 1,000 by a factor of 25. So that's probably one of my best examples of having really terrible constraints and yet still finding a solution. And usually the approach there is to start with the analysis, because while they might not be reluctant to change anything, they're usually very happy to do analysis to figure out, well, what can you change? Or if you could change it, what would make the most difference?
I love that. You're not allowed to change the hardware or the software, but can you change the outcome, please?
Yes, can you make it a lot more efficient?
That's absolutely superb. And the fact is that they already had the answer.
Yes, but they couldn't prove it, that this was worth taking the risk of switching in. So that's where the analysis made all the difference.
I'm completely gobsmacked. I didn't expect that as a, can you change this without changing the hardware or the software? And the answer to become a positive. That was not the outcome I thought you were going to.
Well, I wasn't sure going in, but I thought, well, you know, if they give money, I'll give it a go.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So I've heard you talk elsewhere about accidental complexity.
Yes.
And I could really do with an explanation of it.
So accidental complexity is where the software is doing things which are over and above what the business requirements are. So you've got your business requirements, but then what can happen is you've got all these levels of abstraction, both in terms of your organization, your software, and your hardware. And each of these levels of abstraction means that it has maybe a bit more flexibility than it needs, or more functionality than it needs, or it's doing several translations that end-to-end aren't really required. And each of them, they tend to multiply to the point where you can end up with a solution that is 10 times, 100 times, and in extreme cases, 1,000 times more inefficient than what is required. And the reason I can say that is that it is possible to optimize that situation or that code and do, without changing the business requirements, and do exactly the same functionality, but use far less resources. And the benefit of this is that not only does it improve performance, but by stripping all this out, you often improve maintainability. If you do it wrong, it can make maintainability worse. But in general, we can find a path where you're both improving maintainability and efficiency at the same time. An example I've written about is a very standard test we use for benchmarks is called an echo test. We call it an echo test, where you send a message of a certain size and you can play around with the size, you know, to see what difference the size makes. And then you wait for that message to come back again. And you time how long it takes at different throughputs, because adjusting the throughput and controlling the throughput is an important way to explore, well, how does that impact your latency profile? So I competed against Kafka, which is a very popular messaging tool. It's one of its features is that it's low latency. And in the benchmarks I did, I got results that were twice as good as their own published results. So the widely published results. So they were widely published around 5 milliseconds. I was able to get 2.6 milliseconds. So I wasn't casting a bad light on it, but, and this is doing say 100,000 messages a second, but to do exactly the same test using Chronicle Q, which is also open source, I was getting that down to around 3.5 microseconds. So that's about a factor of 750 times. So they're doing exactly the same task, same benchmark, same piece of basic functionality, which is getting data from A to B and then back again, just to make the benchmark easier. But it's taking substantially longer. And the reason I point this out in terms of performance is because you can measure it. There are other instances where it's to do with maintainability or flexibility or velocity of development. They're much harder to measure. But I believe the same thing happens where developers can start going down a road which it results in much poorer outcomes, like things taking so much longer than they need to, but they're harder to measure. And so, well, you know, I timed this and I came up with a number, so I've got a straight up comparison. So that's the idea of accidental complexity, is when you compare solution A and solution B, and they both do the same job, but one of them is much more efficient, then the difference between them is accidental. And even solution B might have accidental complexity. It may be that solution C, which maybe hasn't been identified yet, will be even better. And often people underestimate how much accidental complexity they have. And in fact, often we will tell people we can improve things by a factor of 10. Not because we're being modest, it's just that they won't believe you say more than 10. We can probably do it more than that in many cases, but they just won't believe you. The other reason that we often say we can improve things by a factor of 10 is that often once we've done that, their priorities have shifted to something else because we've essentially solved that problem. They have other problems. It's not worth them spending even more time taking it further is often where we stop at that. But you know, when we've got an opportunity to benchmark it or take it further, we see that there's further improvement even beyond that.
Presumably they solve some of the other problems and come back to you in the end, because actually now they're back to having the same best bottleneck they used to have, right? Does that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. So in reality, a lot of the problems they have is having a burdensome technical debt. They've just got too much technical debt to fix anything. And one of the symptoms of that is they have poor performance they can't fix, and they can measure that and they can say to their managers, we're not getting the performance we need, because it's a measurable thing. However, them not being able to deliver the software in time is also another form of technical debt, but it's harder to go to your manager and say, it's taking us longer to develop the software than it really should. And the manager's more likely to say, well, that's your problem, isn't it? So you're not going to get the support you need for that kind of argument. So that's where a lot of clients come to us. They're talking about performance, but really their problem is technical debt. And you quickly solve the performance problems, but then to really help them, you now need to launch into what are all the other issues that are getting in your way of being productive, allowing you to innovate, allowing you to improve. And that can be 10 times that in reality.
I mean, we have often been involved in a process where you are hired to solve one problem, but actually in solving that problem, you remove two or three others because you are actually able to oversee with a different set of eyes. And actually the customer gets more than one answer. So that's kind of, I can hear where you're coming from. So what are some of the pitfalls for low latency trading systems? You know, we hear about the amount of money that gets spent on reducing latency, but are some of these things relatively simple, or is it generally always cost?
So I think probably the biggest mistake people make is that they assume that to go low level, you have to produce code, which is very, I don't know, raw, for lack of a better word, where it's very hard to maintain, very brittle, very difficult to understand. And to some degree, that is true, but it doesn't have to be that way. It is possible to both have code that is more maintainable and more efficient, as long as you don't go to the complete extreme. And that's where the 10 times rule can come into it, is that if I can improve performance by 10 times, instead of just going straight for the most efficient and brittle solution, let's just improve it by 10 times, but at the same time, improve your developer performance as well. Because I'm often of the view that the performance and efficiency of your developers is more cost-effective than worrying even about your servers. So reducing your time to market, being able to fix issues, being able to be flexible. The cost of a developer is a lot more than cost of one server, for example, right? So if you can make the developer more efficient, you can probably waste a little bit of money on servers. Not that we advocate doing that either, but the thing is that often comes from a different budget. They're not really thinking in those sort of terms, but that's certainly the approach that we take is, yeah, how can we make developers more efficient? But fundamentally, it comes back to focusing on what are the business requirements, right? And having, this is where behavior-driven development, although it's not very exciting, is an essential tool. You start with what are the business developments in a testable form, and then you implement what is the simplest solution that will achieve that, that has all of your performance requirements, the simplest solution. And then it will also go fast. It's amazing how often the best way to go fast is just do less, right? Don't do all the things that don't need to do. And that's going back to getting rid of the accidental complexity or never introducing it in the first place. And by doing less, you end up with something that's more maintainable, much more flexible, much easier to work with. I had one client that did a POC with us. They'd been working on a project for 3 years. And when I asked them about performance testing, because they'd already worked on this project, well, what sort of benchmarks are you getting now? I said, well, we haven't been able to benchmark it yet. So I thought, okay, that sounds worrying. So we did a workshop, and for a week, we were able to benchmark it. So we were able to implement it and benchmark it just over a week, just actually two of us writing the code. And they had a whole team working on it for 3 years. And again, that came down to organizational issues. Essentially, they'd committed to going down a certain path, and changing course was too difficult for them. But yeah, they were just floored at how much more productive and faster it was to just really just focus on the minimum requirements and just implement that.
I completely get that actually sometimes the outsider can see the root through the trees a lot quicker than the people who are looking in the forest. It's a very clear analogy. So why don't we spoil some of these listeners and give them some of your tips for low latency and trading systems? What should they look for?
There's lots of different tips out there. I think ones that don't get emphasized enough is that's really simple is using microsecond timestamps. I know it doesn't sound like much, but you'd be amazed how quickly it changes people's mindset just to switch from using millisecond timestamps to microsecond timestamps in all their timings. And suddenly, something they thought was, oh, that's fine, it's a few milliseconds. Now they're saying, well, actually, I'd rather it be a few microseconds. And that just changes their whole thinking. And it's such a simple thing to start off with, just getting microsecond accurate timings and infrastructure. And I'm not talking about hardware changes. This can all be done in software. And that's a really simple one. Another one, which is I think is underrated, is Little's Law. So Little's Law is a very old law of queuing theory. It's about basically, if you look at the average time that it takes to serve a person or an event or whatever, and you multiply it by the average throughput, then you can get what is your minimum level of concurrency. So your ideal concurrency. So say, for example, it takes, say, 5 minutes to serve someone at a bank, and you're getting one person coming in every 2 minutes, then you need roughly 2.5 queues or two, you know, three staff, basically. Right? So you can work out how many servers you need to handle the workload you're getting, at least ideally. In reality, it fluctuates. So it's not quite as simple as that, but it's a very simple concept. And the reason I bring this up is that I often have to explain this in my engagements, because they will come in with a view and expectation that certain thing is required without even doing that kind of analysis. So to give an example, I had a client that they wanted to scale to 20 servers. And I said, how did you know that you need to scale for 20 servers? I think basically because they'd had a previous project that didn't scale and that was a problem. So they want to know that that's been solved up front. So then I asked them, well, what throughput are you looking at? Well, 100 a second. What sort of latency do you want to have? Oh, 100 microseconds. So sorry, let's multiply that out. You get 100 a second, 100 microseconds each. That means that you're getting an average queue length of 0.01, which means that 1 in 100 times, 1% of the time, you will have one event to be processing at any given moment. So say your load goes up by a factor of 10. Now, 10% of the time, there's one event in the system. So that means not only you not probably don't need more than one server, you might find that you only need one thread. One thread will do the whole of that and handle bursts of load as well. And that kind of blew their mind. But you'd be surprised how often that has come up, where like someone's implemented a really complex multi-threaded multi-server system. We work out the concurrency and it turns out to be one. Because, and so in fact, there's so much locking and interlocking going on that there's actually only one event going through the system at any given moment.
I've actually got an example of both of those for our listeners where simple things that you're discussing here work. So I do quite a lot of work in trading and execution for buy-side firms. And we ran a program with a set of customers at one point where we changed all their timestamps from milliseconds to microseconds. We made all the requests to all their brokers. We want the reports like this. We didn't change anything else. That was the first step. And our execution quality went up just for the request, because people believe you are measuring to the millisecond. They will have to presume that you're going to spot something that is not efficient. So just making the request itself without changing anything else was actually improving execution quality. It was a giveaway. It was like one of our, you know, open source responses to buy sides. And the other one was, and these truly are American investment banks, but a very big American investment bank, and actually one I worked at, used 147 servers to do a particular process that actually, in the end, required a single figure number. And when they said how many, software provider said, the answer is actually less than one. So one. But for your global infrastructure and data redundancy issues, we suggest one per time zone and a backup. So six. The thing is, the server is not a cost problem. Server costs, whatever it costs. The maintenance of a server in a data center in an investment bank is multiple, and I'm not sure the exact number, but I'm definitely talking 10 times the cost of a server a year, and I might be talking 25. Yeah. So I get both of those, and they're both brilliant. And if no one gets any other value out of this conversation other than you and I are talking about just ask a different question, then they're probably going to win something here. So what's the future for low latency? I mean, are we nearly there? Presumably not. What's emerging?
I would say in terms of emerging, I think the thing that strikes me is that trading systems currently are basically computers talking to each other. They're algorithms talking to each other, very high speed, and speeds that we can't interact with, but nevertheless, we can benefit from by controlling them at a sort of a macro level. And really, I think that gives a bit of insight as to where I think AI is heading. Because at the moment, all the AIs that people have dealt with, obviously, you're interacting with an AI, you might be playing around with it, but it's not, for most people, it's not being used for a business use case. I think over time that will change so that there are more business use cases. But in the future, what I can see happening is that the AIs will be talking to each other. And in fact, when it comes to jailbreaking AIs, a lot of the time they use AIs to do that. So they use one AI to interact with another AI to figure out when the other one breaks. And I think in the future, we will see more of these AIs interacting with each other instead of using some of these binary protocols that we can't read. They might actually be just communicating with something like English or a very standardized form of English, because that's the most inspectable for us. And the overhead of doing that will become lower and lower over time. And yeah, you'll literally have the AIs all talking to each other to negotiate or whatever it is that they're doing to implement their functionality.
Cool vision.
Well, it wasn't that long ago when pretty much most trading was done by voice over the phone or in an exchange. I'm sure you're old enough to remember there were times like that.
Spent many years answering two telephones at once and shouting at people across the trading floor. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's all been automated now, and you might get one trader on an entire floor just managing all the computers doing all of this. And yeah, I think it'll be very similar with AI, and the AIs won't be even talking to other people. They'll be talking to other AIs at other institutions.
So what's Chronicle software going to look like 5 to 10 years out then?
That's a good question. I think the thing is that a lot of the models that we've got, I think, are quite sustainable in the sense that we've grown organically. And so we're pretty confident in the approach that we're taking has a lot of value. I think it will always be niche, but I think we also have an opportunity to grow for us. And that's the way I think our company is going, is we'll get more involved in more on the business side and supporting them a bit more directly, because we do have a lot of business expertise. But the core infrastructure that we need isn't going away, certainly not in the low latency space. Give you an example, when the first computer I ever used only had 128K of memory. That was in 84. And so you got used to coding in a very small space. Now, you might say, well, today they've got access to lots of disk space and they've got lots of memory. But that's ignoring the fact that, well, in a way they don't, because each CPU core has got an L2 cache that's only a quarter of a megabyte. So in 40 years, it's gone from I've got 128K that's local to me and I can use efficiently to 256 kilobytes that's local to my core and I can use efficiently. And the reason that matters is that we're getting more and more cores on those machines. So if you want to use all those cores, you need to be very careful how you use any shared resources, because they start getting in each other's way very quickly. So you have to think about, well, how can I write a program that will fit into a quarter megabyte of memory? And then that will scale very well across all my cores. I can keep doing that. Every one of my cores is using its own private cache, and they will run it without getting in each other's way. So at least in the low latency space, a lot of the principles that have been around for probably 40 years in terms of being really efficient and being very deliberate in how you use your system still apply. And I think they'll apply for at least another 10 years.
Cool. Now, as we approach the end of this chat, let's pick your brains for those people who aren't quite so up on these subjects as you. What are there out there in terms of resources, books, mentors, courses for people who want to go down this route, who might one day become an employee of yours, but aren't they? Where should they start?
Well, the easy answer for me is to have a look at my blog, Vanilla Java. So it's had about 4 million views. You could also look at some of my answers on Stack Overflow. I've got 13,000 answers on there for Java, at least. There's also someone I find inspirational is Heinz Kaputz. He's a trainer who lives in Crete. So the downside is you might have to go out to Crete to do one of his training sessions, but he's really inspirational to me as a teacher. Another guy who I find has always been inspirational is Gil Tenney. He's the CTO of Azul. And I've seen one of his talks on how not to measure latency 5 times in person now. And I don't miss a chance to see it because he brings something new to the table every time he does it. So I think he's amazing. And a lot of his talks are online. So these people have online resources as well. So they're good to go to for that sort of thing.
Do his subsequent courses get shorter? I'm just thinking if he's talking about reducing latency, is his fifth talk shorter than his first one?
Yes, no, he keeps adding things. Yeah, but you're right. It doesn't get any shorter. Might do. I noticed that. Second time I give a talk, it's always like, well, it feels like half the length of the previous one. I think I ramble less.
No, really very interesting. Very interesting and relatable. Because the trouble is this technology and this kind of subject can get to the point where if you're not very deep in the weeds with it, you can get lost. Ooh. So the whole point of this has been very, very relatable. I mean, I'm involved in it, but I'm not involved in it at your level. Ooh. And I found it fascinating. So thank you very much. Thanks to our audience for listening as well. And no doubt you'll be back again for another FM Insights podcast in the future.